Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, May 1st, 2019. Samuel Dong Luoc, who was likely killed by national security officers, according to a UN report, is remembered with his own words.
The space for professional and also activists was closing day by day. But for me, what caused me to leave the country was the case against the chairman of the SPLM.
And South Sudan's Catholic Church is warning the stalemate over the formation of a new government could lead the country back to war.
While a good number of these activities are yet to begin, unfortunately, those pending activities or ongoing activities are the most critical and consequential.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The leader of the SPLM-IO is asking the UN Security Council to refer the case of Samuel Dong Luoc and Agri Idri to the International Criminal Court in Hague for persecution of individuals who might have killed them. Riek Machar, who is confined in Khartoum, said in a statement released today, quote, SPLM-IO condemned this barbaric act. We call upon the government to bring to book all those who committed this act of terror. End of quote. Machar's statement came one day after the UN panel of experts on South Sudan released a new report stating that the government of South Sudan is responsible for the disappearance of Agri Idri, a senior SPLM-IO loyal to Riek Machar, and Samuel Dong Luoc, a lawyer and civil society activist who were kidnapped in Kenya in 2017 by men believed to be South Sudan security operatives. The UN panel report accused the National Security of abducting and transporting Luoc and Idri to Juba, where they were briefly detained. The families of Dong, Samuel Luoc, and Agri Idri told VOA in December last year that senior government officials in South Sudan are behind the disappearance of their loved ones. Idri's wife, Aya Warile, in an interview with VOA's South Sudan in Focus in Nairobi last year, said she holds South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai, responsible for the disappearance of her husband. Warile said Guy has been a close friend of her husband, but said since Idri disappeared, Guy ignored her phone calls and attempts for a meeting. South Sudan in Focus requested to speak with Guy on the UN report, but he declined, saying the government of South Sudan will issue a statement, but did not specify when. The UN panel said the tragic death of Luoc and Idri offered what it called sobering reflections of the challenges facing the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement by the violent legacy of South Sudan's conflict, while highlighting the increasingly unrestricted power of the National Security Service. Human Rights Watch released a statement yesterday calling on the government of Kenya to investigate the kidnapping of Samuel Dong Luoc and Agri Idri from Kenya in January 2007. Jehan Henry, the watchdog's associate director for Africa, says more work needs to be done by the Kenyan authorities to find out how Luoc and Idri were taken to South Sudan.
The Kenyan authorities opened an investigation into the case, and that investigation came up with nothing. And we were very concerned that the police actually did not try very hard to fully investigate, and that it was not a thorough job. There were many witnesses who seemed not to have been interviewed, and it didn't look like a very thorough investigation. And so there was a court ruling that the investigation should continue under court orders. And that process finally drew to a close earlier this year because the court determined that there was nothing left to do and the investigation basically was just abandoned. It was concluded. So we are concerned that the Kenyan authorities have not actually delved into this case thoroughly and sufficiently.
You have been following the court hearings on this matter in Nairobi several times.
Yes.
And yes. What were some of the testimonies? I remember there was a diplomat from South Sudan Embassy who was arrested. Did he testify in court?
I can tell you from what the information that we did get is that there were various people who said that they had seen Dong, you know, shortly before he was taken. There were some indications that there was a phone call made. Actually, it was all very murky and circumstantial. There were phone records taken from somebody who said that he knew how to get them back, and basically we didn't get them to pursue those lines to their conclusion. There were bits and pieces coming out, and they just weren't ever pursued and filled. You know, the investigation wasn't completed.
Today, the information minister, Michael Makuei, in South Sudan, told a local radio station there that people should ask the Kenyan government, because those two disappeared in Kenya and the government in South Sudan has no hands in it. It looks like it's a game of ping pong now.
This is not the first time they've said that, actually. From the beginning, this Makuei, but also the first vice president, Tavan Dengai, has told organizations who are asking, including myself, asking about this case, to go and ask the Kenyans. Now, I think the panel's information shows that we were right all along, that the South Sudanese authorities were behind this. They had more than a hand in it. They were actually ordering it, because these two men did end up back in Juba in the custody of national security. So the South Sudanese government has a lot to answer for here.
Human Rights Watch, your organization, has been handling a lot of cases across the continent. Is there any case of this kind that you have handled somewhere else, apart from South Sudan, where people disappear and you just don't know who took them and who is responsible for their disappearances?
Well, for sure, South Sudan has a big problem with unlawful killings and disappearances, and there are several other people we know of who are missing and at the hands of national security in South Sudan. You know, there's no question that the gravity and the scale of human rights violations in South Sudan is extreme and unusual. The war there since 2013, and then the many decades of war before it, have created an environment in which these crimes can be committed really with impunity. And that is why we have continued to push for justice. We think that is the component or the factor that could start to make people think twice before disappearing their political opponents.
Are there any other names that you're aware of, people who have disappeared in South Sudan in the hands of the national security?
Actually, yes. I could certainly tell you there's two people whose names we've been looking at for now quite some years, James Luwal and Anthony Nero, who were associated with the UN mission. No one knows their fate. And Martin Kenny, also no one knows his fate to date. Also, many people have died in national security custody. And we have names of people who've died, and it's not clear whether the families were ever notified or were able to bury their dead. There's an enormous amount of work to do around the crimes that have been committed by national security services in South Sudan. And rather than seeing the government put checks and balances and accountability into place, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing the national security service is getting more powerful and richer.
That's Jehan Henry, Human Rights Watch Associate Director for Africa. She was speaking to me from New York earlier today. Samuel Dong Luak spoke to this program on December 28 in Nairobi in 2016, explaining why he fled South Sudan. We are airing this interview once more.
I left South Sudan in August 10th, 2013. I came by air from Juba to Nairobi.
I understand you were having one of the successful law firms in Juba, and you've been handling quite a number of high-profile cases, and you have a track record of success. Why did you leave your country?
John, the space for professional and also activists was closing. day by day. But for me, what caused me to leave the country was the case against the chairman of the SPLM, President Salva Kiir, when we represented Pagana Moom, who was by then the Secretary General of the SPLM. And we petitioned the Supreme Court of South Sudan because the chairman of the SPLM violated the constitution of South Sudan by preventing Pagana Moom, the Secretary General of the SPLM, from traveling or even talking or speaking. So we felt that these are fundamental freedoms and they are enshrined into the constitution of South Sudan, and nobody should really prevent any citizen from exercising them. And as the case progresses, I received threat and I decided to leave the country.
When you left the country, you came to Nairobi. How is life in Nairobi? I know you're somebody who is used to making your own money and putting food on the table for your family. How is life for you in Nairobi?
Life, of course, is still very difficult. I have family to take care of, school fees, and so other many expenses. But when I first came, I was supported by the Human Rights Defenders and other organizations for almost 1 year, and then later on they stopped the support. We get support sometimes from our relatives who are abroad. They can send you some money. But it's difficult, very, very difficult.
How do you really feel? Because your country is just 1 hour flight from Nairobi. If you're driving, it's a matter of 12 to 14 hours you're at home. Do you feel like you want to go back home?
Yeah, I really feel that I want to go back home. But of course, John, as a human being, you need to have some freedoms in your own country. If those freedoms are not there, then you better stay or exile yourself, because without freedom of expression, freedom of associations, freedom of enjoying your life as a citizen of that particular country, then it doesn't make any sense. People in South Sudan now, they don't enjoy their freedoms. You know, they meet death every day. You know, even though now I'm in refuge, I sympathize with those people who are living in South Sudan. Even though my life is difficult here, but they are living the most difficult life in South Sudan. I wish that the country get back to normalcy, and then each and every citizen can really enjoy peace and freedom of expression, freedom of movement, right to life, and all other fundamental freedoms.
When I was speaking to some government officials here over the weekend, I asked them that I've seen a lot of South Sudanese in Nairobi who have taken refuge, and they're telling me that they're not able to go back home because they fear for their lives. And this particular government official, I will not mention the name here, he said these are perceived fear. There's nothing that will happen to South Sudanese if they go back home. How do you react to that?
As government officials, they are not honest to the people of South Sudan. You know, death is a daily occurrence in South Sudan. For those of us who always look at the social media, if there is anything our people write most of the time in social media, is rest in peace. Because our people are dying every day, John, every hour, okay? You cannot have a day without, you know, paying condolences to 10 or 20 or 15 people from South Sudan who are dying, not because of illnesses, not because of anything, but because of their life being taken by their brothers who are carrying guns. So I think even those officials, you know, who are in Juba, if you see them, the way they live in hotels which are heavily guarded. They move with vehicles which are heavily armed, you know. And this is an indication that there is fear. There is a lot of insecurity in the country.
That's Samuel Dong Luak, a South Sudanese activist and a lawyer, mentioned in the UN panel of experts report released yesterday. The report concluded that Luak might have been killed by national security in Luri outside Juba town. He spoke to me in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, on December 28, 2016. The Catholic Church in South Sudan is urging the parties to the peace agreement to find an amicable solution to the stalemate over the formation of the transitional government of national unity. The church says the disagreement over when to form the unity government could lead the country back into conflict. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Reading from a statement today, Secretary General of the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba, Father Samuel Abe, says the implementation of the peace agreement has stalled due to a lack of commitment from the parties. Father Abe says the parties have reached a critical stage in carrying out the peace agreement, but instead of facing the challenges and resolving them, South Sudan's leaders remain divided. Abe says the parties agreed to create a unified national army within 8 months to provide reliable security to all parties and to avoid future conflicts. But with just days before the pre-transitional period expires, the parties have achieved very little.
We identified key activities which were to be completed by the end of the period of this. Some have been completed and others are ongoing. While a good number of these activities are yet to begin, unfortunately, those pending activities or ongoing activities are the most critical and consequential.
Last month, at the invitation of Pope Francis, President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar attended a spiritual retreat in the Vatican. Abe says the retreat was for the warring leaders to reflect on their lives and the common mission the Lord has entrusted to them for the present and future of South Sudan and to recommit themselves to building the nation. He says the church had high hopes that both men would come away from the retreat with a willingness to work for peace through dialogue, negotiation and forgiveness.
Our people accompanied the Rome retreat with fervent prayers and great hope, expecting reconciliation of all its members and the beginning of a new era of justice, peace, and prosperity for all. They hoped that the spiritual retreat could transform, reconcile, and unite our political leaders so that they might pursue the paths of peace and reconciliation in the interests of our nation and of our people.
So far, the parties have failed to reach agreement on the way forward. Abe is urging South Sudanese to seek what unites them because they belong to one and the same nation. He says Machar and Kiir should examine their failures and focus on implementing the pre-transitional activities.
The two main principals should humble themselves and attend in person the forthcoming meeting on the current situation. The parties should collectively show the determination and necessary political will to sit down and discuss a compromise solution to the dispute over the formation of the revitalized Tigonu by reviewing the implementation status of the activities of the pre-transitional period and make recommendations on the way forward.
Abe is calling on IGAD to urgently convene a summit of the IGAD heads of state and government to evaluate the implementation matrix of the revitalized peace deal. IGAD's special envoy to South Sudan, Ismail Wise, recently asked all the parties to attend a meeting on May 2nd and 3rd in Addis Ababa aimed at reaching a consensus on formation of the new government. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, civil society groups say the government's U.S. lobbying contract should be cancelled. More on that after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's your opinion about interfaith marriages?
Muslim people, they believe in one God. It's like Christian, they also believe in one God. The only thing is a different what? A different way of praying. I do encourage. I had a friend who get married from Muslim.
So I don't see any problem concerning that interreligious marriage. It depends on the two people. If they love and trust each other, it's okay. But if they don't, that's their problem also.
Because there is a lot of doctrine in Islam, if you marry to a Christian, you must be converted to Islam. And that is why it is not possible that from your denomination, you are taken to a different denomination.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Nearly 20 South Sudanese civil society groups are calling on the South Sudan government to terminate a contract it signed with a U.S.-based lobbying firm to boost ties with the Trump administration and block the establishment of a hybrid court. The groups say President Salva Kiir should publicly withdraw from the contract with gainful solutions. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
A South Sudanese diplomat in the U.S., Gordon Boy, confirmed to South Sudan in Focus Monday that the Kiir administration signed a two-year $3.7 million contract with the U.S. firm Gainful Solutions to strengthen its ties with the Trump administration and block formation of the African Union-South Sudanese-backed hybrid court, which the parties agreed to in the peace deal. In a statement issued yesterday, the civil society activists said they were shocked and dismayed at reports that the South Sudan government wants to obstruct implementation of justice mechanisms in the peace agreement. The activists say at the current exchange rate, the $3.7 million represents more than the amount the government has budgeted for salaries in the entire health sector and more than two-thirds of the salaries of the entire education sector. Jame David Kolok, a member of Transitional Justice Working Group, says the coalition of civil society organizations strongly feels that the government must terminate the contract.
The government of South Sudan must withdraw and terminate that engagement. That's one. Number two, we have also stated very clearly that the government of the United States must stand its ground in protecting the agreement that they have worked tirelessly in ensuring that South Sudan has the peace and stability that they require.
The group says the Kiir administration's move to pay a U.S. lobbying firm to block the hybrid court means the government wants to evade its responsibility in implementing the agreement. David says the lobbying contract would undermine efforts to end years of impunity in South Sudan.
This agreement, if it is implemented, it automatically creates an environment for impunity, because the moment you start removing mechanism for accountability, it sends a very clear message that South Sudan is a ground for committing human rights violation.
Rajab Mohandis, executive director for the Organization for Responsive Governance and a member of the South Sudan Civil Society Forum, says the contract with the Gainful Solutions demonstrates a lack of commitment by the government to carry out the peace deal.
It indicates that the government is not picking its priorities right. Our priorities that meet the interest of the people. Our priority is not getting the Americans to be friends to us. Our priority is to deliver peace to our people. And when we implement the peace agreement and get our people back home and improve the situation in our country, the Americans will come and look for us. They will run after us. And so we need to focus on what our people want, and the world will stand in support of our priorities.
Mohandi says the only way for South Sudan to improve its relations with the international community is to demonstrate good governance and a commitment to peace. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudanese high school students in Juba view the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for them to help build their country. While they try sometimes feel marginalized, they also say they have a flavor to take part in peace process. But this isn't stopping them from organizing grassroots campaign and community service in the nation's capital. High school student Diana Jackson starts the conversation with Edward Wani, Esther Yugu, and Emmanuel Mayol.
I'm currently working with a club called Youth for Peaceful Coexistence. We organize for community events in areas, gathering people together, doing some activities that make them happy and to unite them. We also have some peaceful clubs in school where we unite also as students. We organize activities, co-curricular activities in schools like football, tournaments that bring people from different places to come together. This is the role we can play. But at the government level, we have no option because we are doing ours only from the grassroots level.
As youth in South Sudan, we do some kind of voluntary work to support peace in the country. That is the major role we can do also to support our people.
Yeah, once again, I'm Esther. I'm 17 years old. Yeah, actually, one of the roles that I personally play is actually talking to my parents, because some of the parents actually, the advice that they're giving to their kids is not the advice that promote peace. So I have to start, we have to start talking to our parents in order for them not to separate us, but to unite us. And also, like, the work of the club, I'm also working with the entire club. So our club, we actually, is a club for youth, and we talk about, we discuss about things that are affecting us and you, us youth, and how to bring solution to it. And also, we have, like, activities, such debate. We debate on peaceful topics that can promote peace, and also act dramas that can show that how we can stay together and can bring peace in our society.
Once again, I'm Edward Wani. 16 years, going to 17 within 2 months. We as youth, we play a major role in peace building in South Sudan. Actually, what I do, what I'm doing, and what the rest of my colleagues are doing, I feel like there is a change, and I feel empowered because within a period of time, though it is not going to happen, let me say, within a short period of time, but of course it will have to take a long time, I still feel empowered that within some time to come, we shall have that peace within our nation.
Yeah, actually, I can see that nothing that you can do, action that you can do, doesn't make a difference. Everything you do has an effect, impact in someone's life. Like, as an interactor, we have a voluntary service. Like, when we go and do that voluntary service, it helps others. Actually, like, at times, we go to the hospital, we clean. It actually helps. And at times, like, we talk to the people, like, we have in GBV Club, and I'm also a secretary of GBV Club. And actually, those people who are stigmatized and those people who are affected with GBV, we also talk to them, counseling them. Girls like us in our schools, we work with them in order for them. Actually, it's like GBV is common, actually, everywhere. So we have to advocate for it. We write poems, and we know that this poem, it's like, it inspires others. And some people, like, they'll be like, they want to be like us. So I think it has a difference because people take us as role model in school.
Those were 16 and 17-year-old students from Juba speaking to Ayen Deng Bior about their experiences on peace building. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Mukusa by Charlotte Dipenda.
Nyemba tetena,
eye akoi.
Sisi nyemba mulema,
eye akoi.
Sisi nyemba tetena,
eye akoi.
Sisi nyemba mulema,
eye akoi.
Natala mara mene nyami moto enu mati emba londo e a e oye a. Natalambana bene nyami moto enu masengemba sese a e oh oh a. Natalambana bene nyami moto enu mabolembe dube a e oh yeah. Natalambana bene nyami moto enu.
We have been listening to Charlotte Dipenda with the song Mukusa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.